So another day rolls on. Isn't it amazing? It's kind of relentless passing. Might even think back before you were ever here. How long ago that might have felt. I was just reflecting on yesterday's interviews. Seemed like a long time ago. A lot has happened. Last 36 hours. So no matter what, retreat is a very full, very rich experience, whether it's easy or difficult or both. We're not wasting our time. We're actually slowing down enough to notice what's going on, and that it's quite unusual in this day and age where our culture is so fast and so busy and so complex. So we're doing a good thing here, even if it feels difficult to you. The fact is, we're all sitting down with our stuff, with our minds. And not kind of just blindly inflicting it upon the world. We're actually in the space of our kind attention, grappling with it and dealing with it. And that's a good thing. And I so value that there's quite a number of you new to retreat. And this is your first time, and it can feel like quite a breaking in process to just be sitting for this amount of time without the usual distractions and stimulations. So yay for you, and yay for all of us, those of us who are more experienced. We still work with a lot of the same stuff. And I just have tremendous gratitude to Grove and to everyone who have put their time and effort into making this space available for us. I think it's just really incredible that we can all come together in silence like this and share the natural world and share the Dharma together. And it's a total blessing and joy for me to be facilitating you all doing this. And thank you also to Mary, whose idea it was to invite me. Grove and Mary had done this before, and they needed a third person, and I popped into Mary's mind. Yay! I'm very glad. So the talk I want to give tonight is really about how we are nature. We're practicing in nature, and we think kind of nature's out there and we're over here. I really want to talk in a variety of ways about what an illusion that is and how we are deeply, deeply natural beings. So the talk is titled, So Spiritual an Animal. And I love the title of our retreat, Back to the Woods. And I think we're going even deeper than back to the woods. We're going back to the roots of Buddhist practice. The Buddha got enlightened under a tree. The Buddha lived with monastics in the forest with minimal shelter. Practice began outside, and the tradition has continued outside for much of its history. And so going back, combining nature and Dharma is really going back to original Dharma, going back to our roots. There's all kinds of inspired nature poetry, especially coming out of the Zen tradition in haikus, which were art was forbidden in early Buddhist world. But in Japan, there was just too strong a yearning to not express Dharma through some kind of creative outlet. And so haikus were born as a way of very simply stating what the Zen tradition calls suchness, this kind of place of pure being. And so here's just one example of a person very clearly outside from Dogen, who's a very ancient Zen master, 11th or 12th century, something like that. Midnight, no waves, no wind. The empty boat is flooded with moonlight. So simple, so direct. Can you just feel and see the stillness and the light out there in the water, in the boat? Another haiku from Basho. The old pond. A frog jumps in. Plop. That's coming from quiet mind. There's no philosophizing about frogs. There's just this suchness, this pure presence in contact with nature. So being in contact with nature, practicing in nature like we are, is so great in so many ways. We learn a lot. Nature has a lot to teach us about Dharma. And the first lesson in nature is no comment. You just glance out the window. Slowly that shadow, as I talk, will creep up the hillside. No comment. Trees, meadows, sky, clouds. No comment. Have you ever been to a place deep in the wilderness where you really felt like, I don't think anyone's ever been here, or maybe only been here a long, 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 long time ago? It's so powerful. The silence, the no comment, the suchness. Things just are what they are. And nature's a powerful teacher in this. So maybe you've had a little glimpse of this Wendell Berry line, which Grove quoted a couple nights ago. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. It's a powerful phrase, forethought of grief. Anticipating, creating a future that has a past in it, a future where you will have lost something. And that's taxing. So it's very obvious looking out there, the kind of no comment, the silent, quiet quality of nature. It's like you're going to relate to me as I am. There's no kind of bargaining here. I am what I am. Here I am. Deal with me. That's kind of how nature is. But, even when nature's active, like at the bird feeder, there's still a quality of no comment. So if you watch just that huge dance that's going on at the bird feeder, all the different birds coming in, and Jenny Grove's wife was saying that she's seen a lot of different kinds of birds this year, it's sort of unusual somehow. But you may have noticed there's a real pecking order there at the feeder. The little small birds, little brown jobs, as the birders call them, LBJs. They're just little brown striped birds. They just look nondescript to us. And they're the pine siskins, and they sound like this. sort of, I can't imitate it very well. They have this real, really great sound. You may have heard that. They're the, you know, the small kids on the block. And so they're sitting there, and then some larger bird will come along, and the larger bird will fly right at the bird, and that the bird has to fly. Have you noticed that at the feeder? That's how birds express their dominance. So the pine siskins have to fly when the house finches come in. And they're also little brown jobs, but they have a little bit of a red head. So LBJs with a red head. If you notice them, and maybe a little red in the chest as well. So they'll chase off the siskins. And then the black-headed grosbeaks have come a few times. They're orange and black, and they're much larger than the finches. And they will dive bomb one of the house finches. House finch will have to leave. So the black-headed grosbeak comes in. Then the evening grosbeak comes in, which is this beautiful, beautiful yellow-green-brown bird. And it's got white patches on its back and a little yellow forehead. Have you seen that? I've watched them actually chase off the black-headed grosbeaks. And then the sort of king of the roost up there is a black bird with red patches on the wings, aptly called red-winged blackbird. And I've never seen them actually at a... they usually are on the ground if they come to a feeder, but this one comes right up to the feeder and knocks everything away. So they're just doing that. And these are high stakes. This is food. This is life and death. If those birds aren't eating, you know, they're not going to be around. And when you watch them, they just seem to have this bird way of sorting themselves out. And it doesn't feel like there's a lot of comment about it. There's not forethought of grief that I can see. There's simply, oh, I'm eating, now I'm gone. Big old house finch, you know, scared me away. So even in that context, there's not a lot of comment. And this is really those 2 hours I was talking about this morning. I don't think there's a lot of second arrow out there. I think nature's just one arrow. There's a lot of difficulty, and there's really not much grief, guilt, fretting about it. It just is. And nature is a powerful teacher in that way. They really keep it simple. We, on the other hand, make it complicated. We have this incredible ability to think. And past and future only exists through our thoughts. We create past and future as concepts, creating forethought of grief. So thinking is, you know, called our God-given gift that separates us from the animals. How do you feel about that? You're thinking right now after three and a half days of sitting with your mind. Can feel like it torments us, and we have so many second arrows, so many reactions upon reactions upon reactions. So just right now you're sitting here listening to me, I'm assuming relatively pleasant. Just for a moment, let me inflict the past on you. Just bring to mind something mildly difficult in your life, mild. Some little irritation. And now just let it go. So you may have, when you brought that up, it may not have been pleasant. But a moment ago, you weren't thinking of it. Because I asked you, you picked it up. We create our thought, we create thought worlds, we create our life by bringing up past and future, and we really struggle because of it. Right now, whatever that problem is, you're just simply imagining it. It's not happening, it's a movie. Right now. Right now, there's just this. So you notice that you're hearing. Notice any sensation. Notice where your body is contacting the floor or seat. This is life right here, without the second arrow. It's very simple if we can do it. It's hard to do, but it's simple. Our thoughts make things very difficult. Mark Twain said, "The worst things in my life never happened." I saw Byron Katie, a spiritual teacher, speak in Boulder a few years ago, and she's done a lot of work with torture victims. And they say to a person, the most tormenting part of torture was not the actual acts, it was the fear of the acts that tormented people. So our second arrows, our four thoughts of grief, really pose a lot of challenges. I'll read a poem about a kind of no-comment creature. It's called The Little Duck by Donald Babcock. This is in The New Yorker in 1947. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It's a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. There's a great heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a little like a mandarin, or their Lord Buddha, meditating under the bow tree. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate, as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it, just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he's got religion. I like the little duck too. This poem really captures it. Even the noise of nature isn't noisy. Do you notice that? I mean, the birds are very loud around here, but it doesn't seem to bother us. It's just first arrow world. And then just the quiet of the woods. You may have glimpsed that being outdoors somehow helps your being just settle. Maybe it was when you were lying down the first day, or sitting by the river yesterday, or lying down today. But just being out in the smells and the breeze and the clouds and the trees and the ground, calming and settling us. So nature really has a lot to offer us in terms of helping our mind quiet. And when our mind's quiet, then nature teaches us a second lesson. It teaches us non-separation. When the mind quiets, our separation from everything dissolves. It's very simple. If you've had any moments at all where you've just been fully with a breath, an in and an out breath, without distraction, you may have noticed a kind of feeling of satisfaction, of fulfillment. Because in that, just that little moment, there's not our incessant chatter keeping us separate. Without the chatter, we just belong, we join, we connect. We not only belong to the world, we are the world. We lose separation. The only thing that separates us are our incessant thoughts. If you've had any glimpses of all of that, you know what I'm talking about. And this is really the heart of where our practice goes. Our practice is all about seeing through the illusion of separateness and realizing we already belong. We already, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, inter are. We are interbeing. We inter are with the world. And there's all kinds of literature in the Buddhist world just capturing this joy of non-separation. Here's Li Po, 8th century Chinese poet. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. Quiet mind. This is so joyful when we kind of dissolve and become the world. So it can feel like very bad news that it's our thoughts that keep us in this illusion of separation. But really it's good news. Because if we're creating our separation, then we have the choice to step out of it. That's what letting go does. When we just drop the story, we will have a little moment of peace, of natural peace, peace that's there, what we're looking for, and we're trying so hard to think our way to it. What we're looking for is natural peace, natural ease, natural happiness. But it's not out there. It's here. It's right here. It's in our hearts. It's who we already are when our minds are not so busy. And I heard a talk by a Thai monk once, and this sentence just really grabbed me. He said, all your difficulties take energy to maintain. So just like I had you bring up that difficult thing, that took a little energy to do that. Our path is ultimately about fully relaxing. When we fully relax, that's when we'll be fully enlightened. Just try it for a second. Just relax. Drop your shoulders. Just relax. When you just do this, just for a simple moment, but we do it enough times again and again and again, and we just relax, we start tasting the fruits of practice, natural ease. Natural joy. That's not fabricated. It's not ours. It's just nature. It's wired into us. We can't help but be happy when our mind's quiet. So Ajahn Chah, who's a very, very revered Thai master of the 20th century, who was Jack Kornfield's main teacher when Jack was a monk. Jack tells a story about them walking along, and Ajahn Chah says to Jack, see that boulder over there? Very large boulder. You think it's heavy? Jack said, yeah, sure it's heavy. Ajahn Chah said, not if you don't pick it up. We pick up a lot of boulders, a lot of burdens. Naturally, our minds habitually do it. We all do it. I do it. Grove and Mary do it. All of us do it. But we can just notice we're picking up a boulder. Oh, we can just let go. Yeah, just let it be its own load. I teach a Dharma class, a weekly class in Boulder. And, you know, 15 to 25 people show up every week. A good friend of mine and kind of a mentor, David Chernikoff, has been teaching in Boulder 20 years. 70 to 80 people show up to his class. And it has been really great for me. That is just not, for some reason, a Boulder I've ever picked up. And I was just talking to my wife about it. I could so easily compare. I've been teaching there about 5 years, so I can say, well, he's been here a lot longer. But it's very much within my mind to really like wonder, huh, what am I doing wrong? And what's he doing right? And I got to go there and figure out how he does his Dharma talk so I can, you know, make mine better. It's like, yeah, screw it. Why pick up that boulder? It's such a relief not to do it. I'm so happy not to do it. It's like, wow, that's interesting. That's just what happens. Okay, it is what it is. So this is the promise of our practice. You'll just find yourself suddenly not reacting quite as neurotically as you're used to. And Dharma students that I counsel with, you know, will routinely say that, wow, my boss was this and this to me, and it was so weird. I just let it roll right off. And I'm like, hello. That's your practice coming back to you in the form of grace. You didn't do it on purpose. It's your practice making a difference in your life. So letting go is beautiful and wonderful. And you all have been doing a lot of it. And if retreat feels hard, just know, if you're in a rowboat paddling on a lake and you're going with the wind, it's really easy. And you're just gliding along. We all want that. However, if you're in a rowboat paddling against the wind upstream, you're actually developing a lot more strength and a lot more skill in steering the boat and using your muscles. So if this retreat has been that way for you, you're body building in your heart. You're actually building some muscles that will serve you in your life deeply. I've had hard retreats, and I've left retreats so glad to be gone, and I got back to my life, and I was suddenly in just total bliss. Something had happened, even the difficulty, something very good. It was like I was clean in my heart. It was like I sort of got taken apart, and all the little dirty nooks and crannies got cleaned. And I was put back together by my life, and I was so happy. So don't necessarily think you know what's happening. Retreat works on you in mysterious ways. And you're doing really good, deep work here. You're digging deep, and don't make any conclusions. Just keep flowing with it. And I would say maybe 2 weeks into your life, maybe then you could start assessing how this retreat has been. So when we get really clear, we're not separate. On retreat once, this is just very simple. You'll have these little simple realizations. A woman was crying about three people in front of me. Most people were out of the hall. And I was just so touched by the sadness. It wasn't her sadness. It was just the sadness. My heart was just completely open to her sadness. It was hers. It was coming from her. But it was just the sadness. It wasn't like her over there, me over here. There was sadness in the room. And I was being with it. And I was deeply touched by it. This is what our practice does. It breaks down our barriers, our illusion of separateness. And then we realize we're not just all of each other, inter-are, inter-being, inter-creating each other. We're nature. It's not out there. It's us. We're not separate from it. We harm because we think we're over here and it's over there and I've got to defend this and, you know, somehow keep that. corralled somehow. And it's really interesting, the word sin means without, right? Like Spanish, sin, without. And in the contemplative traditions of Christianity, sin is not held as some damnable act. It's held as separation from God. That's what sin is. So when we're harming, we harm because we don't realize we are all interbeing. We can harm nature because it's not us. But our practice changes that, and we feel the pain. I feel deep pain in the woods of Colorado, where there's millions of acres of pine beetle killed due to climate change. I also feel deep pain because I know that 20 to 30 million acres looks just like that in the Yukon. The pine beetle is devastating our forests. This is unprecedented. It's never happened. And climate change has enabled the pine beetle to have two generations a year instead of one. And then all that carbon that's stored in the trees is going to rot on the ground and get released into the air, thereby accelerating the process in a positive feedback loop. That pains me. It's us. You know, the oxygen that we breathe is being given to us by the plants. We're not separate. So nature teaches us no comment, one arrow only. Nature teaches us interbeing, belonging. It also teaches us a third thing, how to relate to chaos, change, that which we can't control. I mean, we've really had pretty amazing weather, haven't we? It was definitely windy a couple days ago. And we're all having different reactions. I somehow don't get that bugged by wind. Grove doesn't like wind very much. So for me, it's kind of like, this is pretty damn good weather. But what control do we have? It's just going to do what it's going to do. I was on a three-week retreat at IMS in March, and I used to be a wildlife biologist in Massachusetts, and I know that March 14th is the day, the last day when the snow melts in central Mass. And so I was on this retreat starting early March, so I was incensed that the snow was still there March 18th, March 21st, March 25th, still a couple inches trying to melt. I'm like, come on, I only got a week left here. And then it finally melted for a day. For a day, the ground was bare, and it was like the ground could breathe and feel the air again. I was so happy. I woke up the next morning, 2 inches of snow fresh on the ground. And it's snowing all day long. What is going on with the weather?
I love the snow. I go to Barry because there's snow there.
Okay. I remember as a child, you know, going to Sunday school and being fascinated with Noah's Ark and all that. I thought it was so cool. But when it would really rain for a day, I would get really scared. Because what if it rained for 40 days and 40 nights again? So this is the thing about weather. We just truly have no clue what's coming next. And so we relate to it. But we only use one arrow when we relate to weather, you know. We adapt. We complain, sure, so that's the second arrow. But we don't take it very personally. We don't blame ourselves. We just relate to it. It's chaotic. It's changeable. We don't know what's coming next. But we adapt. Guess what? We can do the same things with our chaotic minds and bodies. We can relate to ourselves like weather. Because frankly, we don't have a lot of control. And we'll delve into that. I'll delve into that. A wise friend said to me a couple years ago, you know, the less I practice, the more in control I think I am. The more you practice, the more you see thoughts, body sensations, sounds, moods, emotions. The whole show is coming and going, and I have very little to do with it. Have you noticed anything like that in your 3 days here? Thoughts come and go. You sit down with the intention, oh, I feel so devoted to Dharma, so inspired. I'm going to be so present. In breath, out breath. Ah, yes, the bliss of, oh, huh. Hey, what about Oaxaca, Mexico is a place to go vacation in? I've heard they got a great rug market there. And anyway, oh, wait, oh, right. In, out, in. Did I turn off the stove when I left my yurt this morning? Oh, wait, did I? This is serious. Wait, you know, I mean, if we could control our minds, we'd all be enlightened today. Because that's what we want. We want deep, true happiness that never ends, right? I mean, right? That's what we want. So how come we don't have it? Because our minds are wildly out of control. If you think your body's in your control, let's just do something for just 30 seconds. Just feel a sensation anywhere. Then let yourself go to some other sensation. And then just like you've been practicing, let attention go even to another, just whenever attention is drawn away to something else. When we pay attention to our body, not our idea of our body, but actually feel the tactile sense of sensation, we see that sensations come and go all by themselves. Do you order up an itch? Do you say now it's appropriate for the palm to throb? Or now there should be warmth in the chest? It just happens. This body is nature. The body has a mind of its own. It has nothing to do with our will. The body goes snap, crackle, pop with sensation all day long. And that's why paying attention to the body is so powerful. We get, oh, this little ecosystem that belongs to me actually just is doing its dance. Now, of course, we can step in. We can do some things. We have secondary control. We can change our posture, we can do this or that, but we can't control when the body's going to go in pain, when an itch is going to arise. The body just does it. Isn't that amazing? If we can't control it, how is it us? How is it different from the weather? It's nature. So that might be easy to accept. That, yeah, the body's out of control. But my thoughts, now I control my thoughts. You know, I can decide to think about something. Well, that's true. We do have a limited kind of control with our thoughts. But you may have noticed that your thoughts pinball all over the place. And I'm not talking about a 45-minute sit. I'm talking about 1 minute in a sit. So if I say the word mother, what thought comes to your head? I'll say another one. This time, watch the process. Let whatever word, I'm going to say a word, and let a word pop up in response, but watch the process of this word popping up. Okay? So, ready? Marco, What word popped up? Now, did you say, okay, wait, now Peter said Marco, so let's see, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I'm going to pick polo, that's the right word, or did it just pop out? You can answer. Right, pop out. I'll do another one. Watch the process. Ready? Basket.
Hey.
Okay. Anyone else have a different one?
Ball.
Weave. I've only ever heard those three words in response. Basket, case, ball, and weaving. But again, did you know, did you decide those words or did they just pop up? See, nature gave us an amazing associative 3 pounds, is that how much a brain weighs? This is an amazing association organ. We can think anything about anything. The brain is doing it. Nature is doing it. You do it because of your habits. So we all thought polo because we played the game. You know, if you're from a different culture, you might say da gama or something, you know, because he's, I don't know, invented pasta. But but we are conditioned by our past very deeply, and don't think your thoughts aren't. Our thoughts are pinballing off each other in an amazing associative cascade all day long. It's not personal. It's nature. So the upshot of all of this is if there's not me ordering up all my thoughts, what the heck is? And I want to talk about that as the last part of the talk. But just very briefly to say a little bit about the animal world and how we're a spiritual animal. I once stalked a fox. A friend and I were driving along and we watched this fox curl up in a field. In a little hollow. And we realized we were downwind of the fox, so we could stalk it. We were really into seeing wildlife close. So we walked up, up and up, and then we came over the little ridge where the fox had curled up, and it saw us, and it just looked at us, and before we could have a thought, boom, he was just off. But I never saw fear. I didn't notice any forethought of grief. It was just like, okay, I'm gone. It was so elegant, so efficient. And it just seems like this is how animals are. They're so in the now. So I think we could all agree that about animals. But the Buddha said an interesting thing about animals. He called the animal realm a suffering realm. Though animals are very in the now, according to Buddha, they are absolutely locked in to their passions. So greed, aversion, delusion, the three root poisons that cause our suffering, animals just have to act out. Now, this is a Buddhist view. So there's other views of animals. But in the Buddhist view, animals are slaves to their passions. So that's the suffering realm. So even though they're very in the now, they lack this thing that also distinguishes us. Besides our thinking, what distinguishes us is this capacity for mindfulness. Now again, this is the Buddhist view. In the Buddhist view, we are only in the human realm can we be mindful of our experience and decide whether or not to act out our greed, aversion, and delusion. And because of that, the human realm is the only realm where enlightenment is possible. And I was teaching a class on science and Buddhism at the University of Vermont when I used to be an adjunct faculty there. It was called Knowing and Not Knowing, the Interface of Science and Buddhism. It was a really fun class for a geek like me, and who's also really into the Dharma. So, and I was giving this talk about how Buddhism views the animal world. And it was so cute and kind of heartbreaking. This little 18-year-old kind of hippie woman said, "But I thought my dog was enlightened." I felt so bad to sort of burst her bubble with this Buddhist view. But it is the Buddhist view. And it's a view. You know, you may have different experiences or intuitions with the animal realm. But this is what I mean by so spiritual an animal. That we are highly conditioned by our natural origin. We are animals, but with this extra kick of awareness. So we're just spiritual animals, and when we get out of the way, we get our personal story out of the way, what's left is awareness and nature unfolding. And we're so happy like that because it's natural peace, natural joy, natural love. We just are. So with a little bit of time left, that's kind of the Dharma view on how we enter our, how we are nature. I want to give a little bit of the scientific view too. We're entirely governed within the laws of nature. Are you hard on yourself or others? Well, if you are, guess what? You're a human being. We're all hard on ourselves and others. There's a negativity bias in the brain left over from evolution. So one of our teaching buddies that we trained together, Mary and I, Rick Hansen, has written a book, Buddha's Brain. Now I could get into some comparing there. How come I haven't written a book yet? I'm not even close. Forget it. I don't even want to. Leave that boulder there. He says, part of being human is to have a brain that selectively scans for, registers, stores, recalls, and reacts to unpleasant experiences. Our brains are naturally primed to notice, fixate, store, and remember the negative. It probably has survival value. You know, the person sitting there in the savannah, lollygagging in Dharma bliss, just, you know, resting in a concentrative state, and didn't see the tiger coming or whatever. You know, maybe that person didn't make it into the gene pool. But the person who was scanning ran. So Rick says, our brain is like Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. Studies show that the brain detects negative information much faster than positive. So take facial expressions, which are about as important a cue in our world as possible. Someone's expression, highly important. Fearful expressions are recognized much more quickly than happy or neutral ones by the brain. Our brain is primed for it. It's not personal. It's nature. John Gottman, a famous relationship psychologist, has done a study which shows that in relationships, well, how many would you guess? How many positive interactions does it take to overcome one negative one in a relationship?
5, 7, 100.
100? The answer is 5, according to this study. Check it out. See if that's true in yours. But anyway, we're just primed for the negative. Our failures weigh on us much more than our successes. Part of your Dharma path, if you really want, you know, to be good to yourself, is to purposefully find the positive. Look for it with your sweetie, you know, 5 times a day. This is my little bedtime ritual with Lisa. We each tell each other at least 3, but hopefully 5 good things that happen to us in our day. Such a nice way to go to bed together, to sleep together. That's what we do. And we need to do this to balance out our natural negativity. So we'll just keep going. If you think you're separate from nature, contemplate this. There are more microorganisms living in your mouth right now than humans that have ever existed. If you add up every dead person to the 7 billion alive now, there's more microbes than that in your mouth. You have 90% of your DNA in common with a chimp, 60% with a worm, and get over yourself, 25% of us is in common with a banana, 25% of our DNA. So, you could to see how out of control the body is from the science view, just contemplate the rate of change in the body. We're made up of maybe 50 trillion cells. Over 50,000 of these cells will die and be replaced with new cells while you are listening to this sentence. The body makes new stomach lining every 5 days, a new liver every 6 weeks, etc., etc. Even our brains, which we think of as so much us, are still evolutionary relics. We have a reptilian brain, the brain stem, that controls breath, body temperature, hunger, sexuality. That's pretty much our automatic responses also to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. In other words, greed, aversion, and delusion is coming out of our reptilian brain. The limbic brain is the kind of midbrain, it's the mammalian brain. And this is where emotions are seated, as well as memory, feelings, behavior. And then the frontal brain is the primate brain, the cerebral cortex. And according to neuroscience, mindfulness is located in the frontal lobes. So that tends to reaffirm what the Buddha said about animals not being able to be mindful. You have to have a highly developed middle frontal cortex for there to be mindfulness. And then I'm going to kind of wrap up with a little bit of taking us out of our personal story. So what's controlling our thoughts and our moods and our emotions? Well, a lot of it is our natural heritage. It's conditions, it's past conditions. It's of course our family upbringing. It's of course our cultural conditioning. It's of course what you had for dinner tonight. All of that is having a big effect. But I also want to draw our attention to how we are still very much animals. We're very much alive as animals today, and we have an evolutionary heritage. So a few evolution jokes just to kick it off. There's Larson. Remember Gary Larson, all his great nature cartoons? This cartoon is called Great Moments in Evolution. I'll pass it around. There's three fish sort of against a shore looking up onto the beach. One fish has a baseball bat tucked under its arm, and on the beach is a baseball. And the caption is Great Moments in Evolution. So how are they going to get their baseball? We'll just pass that around. Hopefully you can see it. And then this is the very famous Larson cartoon on evolution. You pretty much just have to see it. But it's the real reason dinosaurs became extinct. And they're all smoking butts together. They're lighting up. So we'll pass that around. So taking ourselves so rock bottom personally, in a way, is cutting us off from the miraculousness of our evolutionary journey. I mean, we all got born, like one day, poof, we just popped out. How great, we're here. But what we came into the world with is an incredible evolutionary heritage. And to take yourself so personally all the time is to really, it's almost like a kind of sacrilege against this sacred connection with not just all of nature, but all of the history of nature. So you might think you're just, you know, a worker at a company in a stressful time, or a parent who feels both the joy and burden of raising kids, or someone who's done just fine in their life but never really distinguished yourself. You know, these are stories that really don't honor the living miracles that we are. Every single one of us, we're living miracles of evolution. The true story of us is so much more magnificent. For instance, just feel in to your body for a minute. The atoms that make up each and every one of us, they didn't just get here from nothing. Before there was the 100 and however many elements, 8, 10, I can't remember, there was just hydrogen. And then hydrogen, over time, in various places, got attracted to itself through gravity and started imploding on itself. And as gravity took over, more and more and more, the hydrogen atoms got denser and started colliding with each other, and bam, helium was born. And this got denser and denser and denser, and other elements, iron, got born. And then this all got blasted out into 9 disks. And I'm talking about our sun. This all happened 5 billion years ago. And these 9 disks over time coalesced into planets. And the elements here on Earth are all born in the furnace of the sun. So the very atoms in our body are literally stardust that congealed as Earth and then somehow slopped up into you through a sperm and an egg and a lot of DNA. So our atoms are not personal. Now just feel into the fact that you have cells, many trillions of cells. And life on Earth began as single-cell bacteria. But over billions of years, these bacteria got more and more complex and turned into multicellular organisms. And the cells themselves started having bacteria just has DNA in it. But eukaryotes, which are a more sophisticated kind of cell, have organelles, little things like mitochondria, ribosomes, this is and that's, that perform functions. Well, the theory now is that those were all separate organisms that not through competition but through cooperation merged into better organisms through actual cooperation. And those cells eventually then glom together to form confederacies of eukaryotes called the multicellular. These are still microbes 700 million years ago. But those microbes eventually become us. We wouldn't be here today without multicellular animals developing 700 million years ago. Take a breath in. The oxygen you breathe did not get here by accident. It got here because bacteria 2 billion years ago invented photosynthesis and excreted oxygen into the atmosphere. So our every single breath, we are literally, sustaining ourselves from the events of 2 billion years ago. It ain't personal. It's evolution. About 75% of your body is liquid. This is from Wes Nisker, who teaches here, who's got a whole book on this kind of stuff called Buddha's Nature. He says, about 75% of your body is liquid, and most of that liquid has the same chemical consistency as the oceans. You literally sweat and cry seawater. It's as if the ocean splashed up on shore and eventually walked away. When you think about it, where else could our bodies have come from but the earth and its seas? You are certified organic. here's a wild one. The fact that we die is not personal. Death was invented in evolution. Bacteria would self-replicate. They don't die. They just clone themselves. But as life got more complex, it became advantageous for two different organisms to merge and create a new one in the form of a gamete, a sperm or an egg joining together and making an embryo. So the parents became obsolete. Once evolution had built life to do this, the parents didn't need to stick around anymore. So sex and death were invented together. And Wes says about this, once the mama and papa microbe got their DNA into a separate new body, it was no longer necessary for them to stick around forever. So the mama and papa microbe eventually became programmed to grow old and die. What happened, to put it bluntly, is that life traded sex for death. Now there's a choice for you. Would you rather live forever without sex or have sex and die? So, do you take your lungs personally? Just breathe in for a second. Air-breathing lungs never existed on this planet until 400 million years ago. A little bit like the fish in the cartoon, where fish came onto land as amphibians, and we went from gill breathing to lung breathing. That's us, 400 million years ago. Actual sex between two bodies, internal fertilization, was invented by reptiles. So fish, amphibians, they lay eggs and the male spreads sperm. But reptiles do it like we do it. So you don't have to take that all that personally either. Maybe just feel your neck or forehead. Just feel the warmth of your body. That's not personal. All mammals and all birds are warm-blooded. 200 million years ago, this is what evolution did for life and for us. It made us warm-blooded, so we keep our 98.6 temperature. The hair on your head, maybe just feel that for a sec. It feels like us. But this too was invented a long time ago, 225 million years ago, with mammals. All mammals have the same hair, even dolphins and whales. They have a little bit of the same kind of hair as us. Feel your coccyx. You don't have a tail, but don't take it personally. primates that we evolved from lost their tails 25 million years ago. And your thumb. Don't take that personally. Apes have five fingers facing forward. 18 million years ago, a kind of ape evolved that had its thumb rotated around like ours. Do you know why you walk on two legs instead of four? It has nothing to do with you. Does anyone know?
So we can get the bearings off the trees.
That's one theory, yeah. 5 million years ago in the East African Rift Valley, the climate changed and dried out, and that enabled lush forests to sort of fragment into savanna, grassland mixed with trees. Apes came out of the trees, and for some reason, we don't know why, it was advantageous for them to walk on two legs. Don't take it personally when you do walking meditation. You are walking literally because of events in East Africa 5 million years ago. You take your brain personally? What's really interesting is the brain enlarged starting 2 million years ago and completed to its present size 200,000 years ago. Now, there's no evidence of symbolic activity whatsoever until about 40,000 years ago. So people think that the brain enlarged for some reason other than intelligence, that there was some selective advantage. Our brain is very has many duplicative parallel processes, very redundant. And no one's sure why the brain, there's lots of theories, evolved the way it did. But it was thought to be long before thinking our brain got big. We can't even take that very personally. So, of course, we are personal too. That's also part of nature. But we're so much more than this. We are the world and we are nature. And we have a long history. And you'll see this more and more clearly as you get more and more aware. The more and more aware you are, the less in control you'll see you actually are. And you'll actually be much happier because it'll make you let go. Well, you let go of the weather. You don't add the second arrow because you know you can't control it. And yes, we can control a little bit. We can control this moment. How we react to the moment we just awoke to, that we can make a choice. But the rest just happens due to nature. So love it. Enjoy it. Enjoy the show. Okay. Let's just sit for a minute. The little duck reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he has religion. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.